In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, an outdoor enthusiast, or a, it says here, a tall comedy icon with flowing ginger locks and a love of American history. Hey, that's me!
Oh, okay.
I think it's me.
Flowing ginger locks?
No, they went too far. Anyway, whatever you are, you'll that's the part you objected to, was the locks? You'll find what you came for in Williamsburg, Virginia, from roller coasters and water parks to hiking and kayaking. Williamsburg is great for thrill seekers of all kinds. If you want that thrill, it's also one of the East's premier golf destinations and a city with an emerging food scene to satiate any appetite.
I like food.
Yeah. You know, I say for your next vacation, visit Williamsburg. Just do it. What are you thinking? Come on. There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Hear me?
I did. I heard you.
And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need. You just say that and they show up. They come jumping out of a shrub.
Oh, cool.
No matter where you are in life, when you need the coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Hey, Conan O'Brien here, and got a little bit of a surprise for you today. There are two of my longtime writers, are Mike Sweeney and Jesse Gaskell, and they have a podcast they've been doing for a while that's really beautifully done called Inside Conan, an Important Hollywood Podcast, and they talk to all kinds of people behind the scenes that have played a role on my show going way back to 1993. And recently, they invited my longtime producer, who's been with me since the beginning, Jeff Ross, and myself on the podcast, and they got us to tell the story of how I pretty much went from being an unknown writer at The Simpsons to hosting this late-night talk show. And it was a fascinating session, and I thought, I didn't expect this whole tale to unravel this way, but it did. So I thought you might like it, and so it's going to play for you right now, if you'd like to hear it. If not, you know, delete. Is that even possible, Gorley?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, great. Don't delete it.
Trust me, I've deleted you many times.
But I was very happy with this and proud of the way it came out, and so we thought that would make it available to you right now. Hope you like it.
And now,
it's time for
Inside Conan, an Important Hollywood Podcast.
I'm Conan O'Brien, and I'm here with Jeff Ross, longtime executive producer. Came in, 2007, I think he came in. No, that's a joke.
He started on the show before you did.
Jeff was there before I was there.
Yeah.
And we have agreed to be on Inside Conan.
Thank
and this
you.
Has been a year-long negotiation.
It's been a lot of back and forth with lawyers.
Yeah. We got the green M&Ms that you asked for.
I wanted to make sure that you had spoken to every prop master who ever worked on the show.
Before you got to me.
Yeah, every custodian.
Well, we've talked to both of you.
That's true.
Separately, but right. Never together. Mm-hmm. And now we're here to compare your stories.
Terrific. We don't think you've ever been in the same room for an interview before.
It's a terrific idea.
Jeff, I think we have.
I think it's a Friday and you're like, you want to start your weekend.
This is just another sandbagging by Mike Sweeney.
I have zero. I wish I had an agenda. I wish I had that
first
much brain power.
Jeff, you just got back from Cabo. You've been away for
fair.
A week.
What?
And, yes.
And he's acting like, I've got to
exactly.
get back.
Exactly. And he's already like, what am I doing here? I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
He has his own tequila now. It's a subsidiary of Cabo Wabo. It's called Jeffy Weffy's Cabo Wabo.
It's actually called Conesy Wonesy.
Conesy Wonesy. Conesy Wonesy.
We're not promoting that on this podcast.
Well, no. You just did.
It's a good
and
idea.
That's not coming out. That's how we pay the bills.
Only CBC products.
But so we're here and we're open to this examination. This
This is the Warren Commission on Conan O'Brien's career.
I'm getting the impression you two never talk to each other.
How could one bullet do that much damage?
We just passed the statute of limitations, so now you can't be prosecuted for anything in those early years.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we can start at the very beginning. What were your first impressions of each other?
Well, we should tell the story that...
How you met.
Yeah. Because, and then I'll set it up, and then Jeff, you can take it away. Yeah. Basically, to take people way back when, in the Wayback Machine... David Letterman announces because he didn't get the Tonight Show, he's pissed. And he's angry. He feels like that he was in line for that. Jay got it. Forget his last name. So Letterman's upset. And then he does the thing that NBC doesn't see coming. He says, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And they never thought he would do that, I think. And so suddenly there's an opening. They need a host for 12:30. And... at the time, people don't understand now. Now, I mean, there's no such thing as a time slot anymore, really. But there's just an infinite number of jobs now and shows. Back then, when there was a space available, it was like a once in a decade event, especially in late night.
It was a big deal.
It was a huge deal. Yes. And everyone was like, who's going to replace Dave? And the affiliates were getting nervous. So NBC had an idea, which is to stall. And to keep the affiliates calm, we'll just tell them Lorne Michaels is going to figure it out. Mm. The, you know, producer of Saturday Night Live, and he always makes the right choice, so Lorne will do it. And so Lorne agreed to that, I think, you know, and with the understanding that he would produce it. And that bought NBC some time with the affiliates. They're like, whoa, oh, good. Well, Lorne is figuring it out.
It's being handled.
It's being handled. And so then...
And that's great shorthand.
It was a very good idea. And NBC has only had good ideas. This was an incredible team, a brain trust. And then they... So Lauren's handling it. And then Lauren's first move before he picks anybody is he knows a young lad named Jeff Ross. Mm-hmm. And he dials the phone. Jeff... fresh back from Cabo, even back then.
I knew it. This is going to be an hour of me getting abused.
No, not at all. And by the way, this is a six-hour episode.
It's more like a rectal exam.
Yeah, so...
it won't be that pleasant.
Yeah. Those you get medication for.
In Mexico.
I love a rectal exam if I get the wrong propofol. So, phone rings, and Jeff, you take it from there. I'm leaving.
Lauren says to me... I guess it was in the news, or we all knew he was going to produce the show and pick the host. And he says to me, would you produce it?
And I said, how did you know Lauren?
I'm sorry. Well, that's true. That's
a good thing I'm here.
Yeah.
That's called a follow-up question.
I had spent a year in Canada producing The Kids in the Hall. And then I was doing some other shows for Lauren and a lot of HBO specials. And I was around and Lauren knew me. And I guess he just hire somebody to do something on this thing. So he called me and he was like, so, you know, I'm doing this thing. I got to produce the show to replace Letterman. I go, I heard. And he says, you want to produce it? And it's sort of to what Conan was saying. It's such a surreal thing, let alone, obviously you want to be the host. Somebody says, you want to produce the show that's going to replace Letterman, which was the biggest thing at the time. Mm-hmm. And there's no idea who the host is. So I wound up in this sort of like crazy whirlwind of nutty ideas and going to auditions. I think at the same time, he was talking to you.
He talked to you first because I knew I had heard your name.
We hadn't met yet.
We hadn't met. And Lorne, I had left SNL 2 years earlier, maybe 2.5 years earlier, and gone to The Simpsons.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I was in Los Angeles and I had moved on. Lauren very sweetly had really wanted me to stay at SNL, and he was saying, you can work from home. It was really nice.
Wow, yeah, he was ahead of his time.
He really was. He said there's going to be a terrible virus.
You never have to come in,
right. You know.
There's a virus in Wuhan.
You know.
And I said, no, I really have to go. I was going through a lot at the time. That'll all be in my memoir. I was going through a lot of stuff in my personal life, and I was, I think, very unhappy, and I just decided I've got to leave the East Coast. And so I got this great chance to work on The Simpsons. So I'm there and I really feel like I've put New York in my rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. And I've put, even though I had an amazing experience at SNL, I thought that's all behind me now. Mm-hmm. And then it's now 2 years later and the phone rings and it's Lorne. And he said that he's setting up the new late night show to replace Letterman. And I'll remember very clearly me saying, well, good luck, because there's no replacing Letterman. And I was quite
sorry for whoever gets
job. I really
just
did.
Just show a test pattern.
And I think Jeff probably felt the same way. We both felt like, I mean, he had been, you know, Dave had, you know, recreated the talk show and created this whole new sensibility. And it felt like, you know, he had discovered this whole new continent. Mm-hmm. And how do you follow that?
And he had carved out 12:35 as this.
Yes.
I actually thought it wasn't really going to happen.
You thought what?
I just thought it wasn't going to happen.
Oh,
what
really?
Do you mean?
In other words, either Lauren wasn't going to produce it or, you know, something was going to happen and I wasn't going to produce it.
Right.
So it just seemed not real at the time.
Did you hesitate to say yes to producing this show?
No, I said yes.
You just jumped right in.
Yes.
Okay.
You said there were a lot of crazy ideas, but I didn't believe it.
Okay.
And so Lorne at first is talking to me about being the kind of head writer, you know.
Right.
So Jeff will be the producer who makes it all happen, and then I'll be the head writer sort of producer. And I remember initially being like, "Well, I'll talk to you about it." I had a contract at The Simpsons.
Right.
That technically wasn't breakable, which sounds crazy, but
Fox is hard. They don't.
I'm not kidding. They.
I've heard
and
that.
So
that's later on in the story.
Yeah. I had signed like a 4-year deal to be at The Simpsons, and I think I was doing a good job and they liked having me there. Uh-huh. So this is not a place, not The Simpsons, me specific here. Fox is not a place where you can just say, you know what?
Right.
I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And so there was that. And I also kept saying, I don't think anyone can replace Letterman. I mean, I was saying that and thinking that and actually still believe it. So,
and I see no evidence.
No, I'm not kidding. I still think that's the case.
Case closed.
But so Jeff and I are, I think we didn't talk yet, but then at some point we hadn't met yet.
Right.
Jeff's just a name. And then I bow out. I say, you know what? Mm-hmm. I remembered having an anxiety attack, a really strong anxiety attack, and thinking I just can't do this. And I called Lauren, actually went and met Lauren, who had an office at the time at the Paramount lot. Right. And I just said, I can't do it. And he was, I think, a little rattled because he was telling people, I've got this lined up. I've got Jeff. Yeah. I've got Conan.
I think he's trying to put pieces together.
He's trying to put the pieces together.
This is an anxiety attack just on being the head writer of the show.
Yes. Yeah.
And you don't know who the host is.
And I don't know who the host is. Right. And so I bow out. And so I'm out of the process. And I remember feeling a huge sense of relief. Huge relief.
Yeah.
Then a couple of weeks go by. And Lauren, I think, had a showcase. And I think Jeff went to the showcase.
Well, I was on the East Coast doing another show. And I had to come to LA to do a different show. And Lauren calls me to his office, the same office at Paramount. He says, well, can you go to this showcase tonight at the Improv?
Uh-huh.
And we've talked about this before. Yeah, it was like five comics, all male, I believe.
Right. And they all knew that they were auditioning for Lauren.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Lauren was there. And so were the guys who were the network. Don Allmeyer was there. Uh-huh. Warren Littlefield was there. John Agolio was there. He was like the business affairs guy. And afterwards, what was the restaurant?
Those guys are always good laughers.
Remember the mustache? Oh, yeah. Remember the mustache cafe?
Biz Affairs.
The mustache cafe.
It was across from the...
I remember the mustache cafe.
So afterwards, they're all going to us. And Lauren goes, come with us. And I'm thinking, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And we go over there and I'm sitting there and he goes... Well, and everybody's arguing about who they thought was good and who was not good. And and Olmeyer goes, everybody meet in my office tomorrow. And Lauren turns to me and goes, can you come to this meeting at Olmeyer's office? And I go, sure. And so I go to this office. And this is when the connection started.
With Conan.
Olmeyer's kind of beating up on everybody. Because that's kind of the way he was, you know.
Yeah, he was Don Olmeyer. You all know him, but you know him because he was running NBC when the OJ trial was happening. And Don was very good friends with OJ and would get very upset when Norm MacDonald would do jokes that basically said, for reasons I don't see the evidence,
guilty.
but basically say that, on the day of the verdict, Norm MacDonald said, well, it's official. Murder is now legal in the state of California. That really didn't endear him to, this is just to tell you who Don Olmeyer was, but Don Olmeyer was kind of like, imagine Babe Ruth at around 45 years old, like a big... Over the top. And I have a lot of affection for Don. I want to make that clear. I really do. And I think he had a lot of really good qualities. And he was very loyal to me in the long run. So there's a lot of things about Don that I have very good feelings about, but he was, he could be very intimidating, yes, and be kind of, he had a sports mentality because he had come from the world of sports. So it was a lot of like,
right,
kicking guys in the ass and get out there.
Come
and,
on, you got to figure it out.
Get your head in the game, you fuckers. And it was that kind of
so
attitude.
So he was sort of putting everybody on the spot to come up with Don, and Ludwin was there, and Rick Ludwin.
Yeah.
And so finally, Lawrence says, well, I think Conan could do it. And he turns to me and says, don't you think?
Oh, wow.
And that was the first time he'd brought it up.
He had not met.
And he had never met me.
And so I smartly go, yeah, I think so.
That's how you survive in show business.
Exactly.
Great improv skills.
And I'll never forget this. And then Omar goes, well, can we test him? And then Lauren turns to me and goes, can we test him? And I go, yeah, sure.
So what happens is I'm working at The Simpsons like a normal everyday Joe, and I come home with my lunch pail and my hard hat, and I put it down, and I see that there's a machine. The machine, this is back when you had a machine with a blinking light.
Let's explain what an answering machine is.
Yeah. So I play it, and it's not. Lauren doesn't leave messages to this day, but it's one of his 35 people saying, "Conan, could you give Lauren a call?" So I call him, and he said, "Look, I know you don't want to do it, but would you be the head writer? But would you be interested in going to an audition?" Now, I had a panic attack at that, just the idea that I would audition because I was a writer. Now, things have changed a lot since then. This is before, I mean, now Seth Meyers, John Mulaney, there's just this long tradition. Tina Fey, people are writers and then they get elevated and they figure it out. This hadn't really happened before.
Right.
And there really was, behind the scenes, I had been kind of a performing writer for a bunch of years, doing improv,
groundlings
and improvisation, and constantly, it's where I met Lisa Kudrow, I started doing improv in 85. And I was very interested in that, but I was not a stand-up comic, which is really was considered, you have to be, it's like to drive a car, you need a license.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean you're not a stand-up comic? Right. So
that was the mindset back then.
Yeah. And I remember at SNL, Jim Downey was always putting me in things because I was the guy who was in the room entertaining the room.
The writers.
Yeah. In a room full of writers, and to this day, my favorite place to be is in a room full of writers.
Yeah.
Trying to make everybody laugh and doing a dance for them or spinning out some wild thread. And so I think Lauren had seen me doing that.
Right.
He had seen me cracking up Jim Downey, and he had seen me, you know, play little utility roles and sketches here and there.
Right.
And so the notion was maybe. So he talks to me. I'm very nervous. I call Robert Smigel.
Imagine. Yeah.
Robert Smigel's initial response was, you know, I wouldn't do it if I were you.
Oh, wow.
Now, listen, I'm going to...
That was for your own sake, I'm assuming.
Listen, to be honest, he was echoing everything in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
What everyone would say.
Yeah, he said, I wouldn't do it if I were you. And I said, and what's the reason? And he said, because that is a hard way to get into show business. Like, you're a complete unknown, the knives will be out. He said all the things that ended up, to a large degree, playing out. And he was telling me all that, and I was nodding. I remember this was an apartment on Cochrane. Not Cochrane. That was my earlier
Johnny
apartment.
Cochran.
I moved around more than like Ted Bundy.
Bundy Drive.
Yeah. Bundy once said to me before he was executed, you moved around a lot. And I'm like, you know what? That's my business. But I was on Weatherly, which is kind of near the Four Seasons Hotel.
Yeah, you could walk.
So I remember being in this, I had this little like... I was a guy that didn't know how to furnish an apartment. I just wrote and ate out at Chinese food places at night and worked on my Simpson scripts, you know, completely undeveloped male human. And I was in this little breakfast nook, and I remember very clearly the table I was sitting at, talking on this shitty little phone, and Robert saying, I don't think I would do it. And I was like kind of agreeing. And in the background, I heard Michelle, his wife, say, who's fantastic. And Michelle, I just heard her in the background go, "Well, you're on the moon." And I couldn't quite hear her. And I said, what did she say? And I heard Robert talk to her. And then he came back to the phone. He went, well, Michelle says, what do you have to lose? And then I heard in the background, Michelle was like, he should do it. What does he have to lose? He's funny. And I had this little like tremor of maybe.
Yeah.
What do I have to lose? And then Robert went, well, that's a really good point. So I thought, well, what's the worst that could happen if I audition? I'm not going to get it, but I'm interested in this getting out in front of people. So that's when the next thing I know, I'm told by Lorne, okay, we're going to test you. You're to go meet Jeff Ross at the Four Seasons Hotel, which in Beverly Hills, which was like a 5-minute walk from my apartment. Mm. So I walk over, I get to the lobby first because Jeff's upstairs, beauty regimen, putting the cucumbers on his eyes.
True. He needed a spa hotel.
Yeah.
And, guilty as charged.
And I'm downstairs and there's a lobby. They've changed the lobby of the Four Seasons now, but there used to be this kind of business desk that was made of Lucite. Right. It was like a clear plastic desk. And I was sitting at that clear plastic desk, just waiting. And then Jeff comes off the elevator. We've never met. And he walks around the corner and goes, and I go, Jeff goes, Conan? And I go, Jeff? And I go, yeah. And then I gesture to the desk and go, what do you think? Like,
true.
I could.
True. I thought you went like this.
Yeah, I kind of hit the desk and went, what do you think? And Jeff was like, I don't know. And I was like, yeah, I know. So then we talked about
it. How crazy it was, honestly.
So the chemistry was off the charts.
Yeah, right away. You know what I love? My first interaction with Jeff was disinterest.
Right.
And no faith in me, and nothing's changed.
He would have been looking at his cell phone if he'd had one.
There was no cell phone. No, Jeff used to carry a rotary phone. Jeff had a rotary phone in his jacket.
Long cord.
Long cord. And it was always getting tangled to things. He's like, come on, I got to check my messages.
Can you unroll me?
It's just another example of how surreal the whole thing was. You couldn't really believe in your heart it was going to happen.
Like, you're probably both laughing at the
yes.
Oh, it was completely absurd.
Out of this.
And I have to
it's
say,
such a crazy
I was laughing at that point because I took what Michelle Roberts' wife said to his heart, which is, oh, what the fuck? Just try this. It's not going to happen anyway.
Right.
So
you'll probably regret experience. Not
this,
doing it.
This
yeah.
story,
yeah.
I mean, we could do 9 hours on this story and I'm trying to move it along. Yeah. But long story short, Jeff starts to, with NBC's help, starts to put together kind of like an audition. Mm-hmm. And the only space they have to use is the Tonight Show. It's always been good luck for me. So the idea is when Jay's done with his show, he's going to leave and the crowd's going to leave. They're going to bring in another audience and I will come out and do a monologue and then interview two celebrities. And I won't know who they are till I get to Burbank.
Wow.
So Jeff was putting it together and trying to find the celebrities. And I had nothing to wear. So at the time, I call my best friend, Lisa Kudrow, and I say, Lisa, you've got to help me. And she says, don't worry, I can help you. So she took me to...
Ooh, makeover montage.
Well, it's hilarious. This is the worst makeover montage, but I had no one...
You went to Sears.
Two-thirds of the way through the movie, that's when they happened.
We went to Best Buy. And,
we went to the big and tall
show. We went to Fred Siegel.
Oh.
Down near Santa Monica. And so I have a... this is in... I have a 1992 Ford Taurus with a stick shift.
Yes.
Very proud of that. We still have, by the way,
still,
Jeff. You know what? I can't believe
I know.
It is. It's still on our budget.
Oh, my
like,
God.
Of the things
to pay for.
What is it paying for?
I don't want it.
It's. No, but I mean, it's paid off by now, isn't it?
No, no, no. It's not the car.
You got to store it somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, storing it.
Yeah, we bought a 50-year. I got on the 50-year plan. It's not a house, Jesse.
$12
you don't get a mortgage.
It could be, you could make it an Airbnb.
So,
you could be earning money with that car.
So I pick up Lisa. We drive over to Fred Siegel and we go to, we're walking around. Now, I now know things just from being in show business. I kind of know like, they should put some makeup on me.
Yeah.
But I also know kind of when you're my coloring, what are good colors to wear? Mm-hmm. Like blues are really good.
Yeah.
They make the old blue eyes pop.
Mm.
And they also, what colors really help if you are very, very pale redhead. The one thing I've learned that you're not supposed to do is wear very, very pale, like white.
Uh-huh.
I should not wear that. So Lisa and I together, we committed this crime together, like Leopold and Loeb. Individually, we would not have killed, but together we did. We pick out a white linen jacket.
Oh.
A white linen jacket and like a white shirt, I think. And I throw it in the back of my Ford Taurus, which, by the way, I later found out has radiator fluid in the back, green radiator fluid, which got on some part of the jacket that I hid. But
I love that Ford Taurus was the car you drove to do this.
So then Jeff sets this thing up and we're kind of talking back and forth.
Yeah.
Then I drive, it's set up for this time. I drive to Burbank. And when I get there, you guys had worked it out. You had found Mimi Rogers.
Jason Alexander.
And Jason Alexander.
Right. As guests.
As guests.
Yeah.
And Jason Alexander, of course, doing...
Seinfeld at the time.
Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And Mimi Rogers was doing movies, right. And she had been a model, modeled, and, you know, and so...
Married Tom Cruise. They,
yeah. They... brief marriage to Tom Cruise, I believe. Yeah.
Worth mentioning.
Yeah. And then my first time getting interview notes, so I got research. You, Jeff, had arranged, had asked NBC, right. And they said, yeah, we can use the Tonight Show research. So I was given research that they had on file for the last time Jason Alexander had been on the Tonight Show and the last time Mimi Rogers had been on the Tonight Show. So I go in this office and I'm just looking and I'm scribbling out my monologue, which I had been thinking about.
How you far had to write that?
Yeah, I had no writers.
Oh,
oh my God.
God.
How far in advance of the taping was this?
Hold on.
What?
What is that?
Oh my gosh.
The Vikings are landing.
He didn't mute his phone.
Oh my God. It was like a horn. It was like
It was
a Norse horn.
Yeah.
It is. By the way, I want to use that. Get that ringtone.
I'm in the North Bend. If you see the movie, I interrupt a tribal ritual with my phone. So please check out the North
please
Bend.
Please keep that in. So I like these are the best moments. Yes. Mike Sweeney's phone just went off and his ringtone is a Norse
He's
horn.
He's been
in
doing
distance.
This for 25
how
years.
How far... How much time
there wasn't
before
that
the
much,
taping?
There wasn't
was
that much
that
time.
This was, you
well,
were,
oh, this is yeah. maybe the Tonight Show was still going on when I got there. They were still taping it, which might be maybe they taped it, I don't know, 5 to 6 or something.
Right.
And so this would have been after that. I think our taping was going to start at 7, something like that. I'm going over the notes. I had come up with an idea for a monologue.
Wow.
It wasn't topical.
Yeah.
Which would sort of foretell the kind of comedy I liked. But it was all about the absurdity of me. And I remember the monologue was kind of, I think you can see it now, but I think I was very taken with, I need to get this job quickly because the Irish don't age well. Oh. And it's a theme I've been working a lot.
Well, I was going to say, holy cow.
And yeah. I was like, and I was like, my face is acceptable for television now, but as Ted Kennedy is proof that my face is going to expand. And I had this whole, and then what I remember most is... Then it's time to do it. It's really surreal. Jeff's over at the, you know, at the podium and we go, there's no band or anything. And I come out and I was immediately surprisingly comfortable. I was just I had always liked being on stage.
Yeah.
And this felt, I was very comfortable doing the monologue. And then I slid over and the minute I got behind the desk, I was just kind of happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mimi Rogers came out first. And then Jason Alexander was second.
I don't know if you remember this, but in between the two, it was like a commercial break, like a fake commercial
break.
What
happened?
In a script packet, I guess it was the research or something.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember this. I wrote on the, and I just scribbled it on the back, you're killing.
Yeah.
And I slid it in front of him.
And what he did was he...
And he looked...
Yeah.
It's called producing
tie or
people.
Something, or,
yeah,
or,
yeah.
Or, you know, I don't
do
know
you still have it? That's long.
No. We shredded everything immediately.
Right. Jeff wanted
we were like the
shred it.
We were like the Germans as the Russians came.
Right,
we were just shredding and burning everything. But yes, I remember that very clearly. And what I remember is the monologue went well and I just felt comfortable doing it. And it was very me.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to like tell jokes about Clinton or tell... I was just...
And you're doing great icebreaking for that audience to like...
Yeah.
You
to
knew
to
that
you.
They didn't know who you
well,
were.
Well, also to let them overcome the shock of this is a very right. pale man wearing right. a white right. linen jacket with radiator stains on the back. But then I cross over and I talk to Mimi Rogers.
That
and,
went well.
And what I remember was there was a moment, which if you look at late night moments since... Mm-hmm. or whatever, you'd think, well, this isn't that, it was fine.
Right.
But what happened was you got to see kind of, for a second, I think, a Conan-y, I was myself.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So Mimi Rogers is talking and I'm interviewing her. My posture's terrible, my hair's all droopy, I'm wearing this awful jacket and I'm listening to her and then she said, yeah, you know, people, I model and she said, and a lot of people say, modeling's easy, but it's a tough job. And I was being polite and agreeing, going, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I can see, I can see. And then I just stopped myself and I go, wait a minute. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. a tough job is like turning a big crank.
Right.
And I mime turning a big crank. That's a tough job, turning a big crank. And people laughed and it was very spontaneous. And the Jason Alexander went, well, but that was a moment of me just interrupting and then almost acting out a cartoon
physical
image.
Comedy, yeah.
And, inserting my personality into the situation. Right. And then it ended and I went with, I think Lisa and I went to Man, I wish I could.
Back to Fred Siegel.
Yeah, back to Fred Siegel to sue
Return
them.
Return the jacket.
To sue them. Right. Yeah, we put the jacket back
on the
shelf. I don't
know how that stain got
and
there.
And I said, yeah, I can't.
It came like that.
I can't wear this.
There were cell phones then, because I remember driving away.
They were huge.
A car phone, yeah.
And I was in the car, and Lauren calls me and says, that went well. And I went, yeah, because he was watching in New York. Mm-hmm. And he goes, but it's going to be Shandling.
Yeah.
Oh.
Right. So right away, now this is—
which I kind of knew.
No. Yeah.
So, that they were talking.
So I had done this thing, and this thing, I have to say, the audition made me really want to do it, because I thought, I was like a duck that had never been put in water, and suddenly I was like, oh, that felt—
right.
That I'm, and I'm not used to feeling good about anything.
And it'll only go well.
Yeah, exactly. It'll only go that well.
But you had a total flip where you're like, now I want
this. Well, I was excited, but I couldn't even let myself think that yet. So I was excited, but I couldn't get myself to that point yet. But I remember we went out to Kate Mantellini. Remember Kate Mantellini, that restaurant that's on Wilshire? I went there with Lisa, and everyone was really excited. And then I was 29 at the time, and my 30th birthday was about a week and a half away. I remember that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So then when my 30th, I'd go back to The Simpsons, and it was just, well, get back to work.
Yeah.
And, and then I had a conversation a couple of days later. Lauren called me. And I was in my car. So you're right. There were giant car phones, but you know, I was in my car and Lauren called me. He loves to break bad news on over a phone in a car. And he told me, you were great.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll never forget. He said, Bob Wright loved your interview and he loved the whole crank thing. When you did the crank thing, he loved that. And I remember thinking, who the fuck is Bob Wright? I don't know who Bob Wright is. I didn't know who Bob Wright was. And I said, well, and he said, Bob Wright loves it. And Suzanne really loves it. And I said, well, who were they? And
and
Lauren was like, what are you talking about? He's the president of—
he ran the network.
He ran the network of NBC. And he and his wife, they expressed them this videotape out in Connecticut. And they watched it. And they're like, we like this weird Irish kid with the funny name.
Yeah.
And that crank thing, man, that really cracked us up.
They're still talking.
Wow. Yeah. And so, but then he called me later on and said, you know, the same thing that he had told Jeff. He said, look, it's not going to be you. You're not going to get 12:30. But you did yourself a lot of good, and they're probably going to give you like 1:30. And I remember thinking, well, that would be great because there's no pressure.
Right.
If I got 1:30, there's no pressure. And wait a minute, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'll never
then
forget.
Then you started wanting that.
Yeah, yeah. I still want 1:30. I take that now.
No one will give it to you.
But I hung up the phone, and I was with Lisa. And Lisa's like, well, that's, you know, so you're not going to get 12:30. And I said, I don't know if, I don't think the Shandling's going to happen. And she said, well, Lauren just told you it's going to happen. And I said, I don't know why, but I just said, it doesn't make sense to me. Gary is a peer of Dave's.
Mm.
And he's killing it with his own show, Larry Sanders.
Yeah.
And he's getting all of this critical acclaim and awards for making fun of the form.
Right.
Who wants to go in every day and try and do it?
Yeah.
And I said, it's not going to be Shandling. I don't think Shandling's going to do it. I think it doesn't make any sense to me. He's too cautious. He's too smart. He's not going to want to go in every day and figure this out. And sure enough, that's what ended up happening.
Yeah. I think I told the story, but I was out for lunch or something. I had an office at Broadway Video in New York. And I come back and I had all these messages when they used to be like paper messages that you would, Yeah. And they were all people that had something to do with it. It was just obvious. I was like, holy shit, he got it.
Oh, wow.
And how long? It was just a couple of weeks after.
What was it?
I remember one of the last things I remember from the old life, the black and white portion of Wizard of Oz, before I opened the cabin door. What I remember really well is I had a birthday party. It was when I turned 30.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it at my apartment on Weatherly. Apartment on the second floor was a sort of a duplex old 1920s place. And all my friends at The Simpsons and my writer friends came over and everyone brought gag gifts. Like someone brought me Arsenio's, like had written a book, like his, and people
all knew that you were in this process.
That was gag.
No, everyone knew that I was in this process and everyone was talking about it, but it was kind of funny. You know, well, here's your how-to book by Arsenio.
And everybody's,
Jeff was there. And we had this nice birthday party, which was April 18th, 1993. And then it was
I was like, see ya.
It was
nice to see you. I'm going back to New York.
Yeah, Jeff's going back to New York and I'm get on with my life. And it's in the back of my mind that something might happen, but I don't know what.
Right.
And I want to say it's maybe I could look up the exact date, but It may have been a week later. I'm in a record at the Simpsons. It was in the basement in the building on the Fox lot. And the way you do a record is there's a table read first. Right. So the whole cast is there and we go through the script and then it's done and everyone applauds. And then what happens is we quickly talk about what changes may need to be made before they start doing the record. And the writers are all going to work that out, make these changes as they're recording to try and tighten it up just a little more. And I remember we had just finished and we're starting to talk about it when there's a phone call and someone in the room said, Conan, the phone's for you. And I picked it up and I put the phone to my ear and it's Gavin Pallone, who's still my manager. I've been with him forever. He said, you got 12:30.
Oh my God.
And I don't know why, but I went, and I said this not in a celebratory way. Right. I said it in a defeated way. He said, you got 12:30. And I went, I know. Because I just had this.
You had a premonition.
I just knew for some fucking reason.
It wasn't over.
Especially and so once what you I didn't want it. Was then
I hung up the phone. Yeah, I hung up the phone and I start to quietly walk out of the room. I didn't say anything to anybody. Leave the room. I go, I walk up the stairs. I walk outside. And I was told by Gavin, I said, I know. And then he said, Don Omer is calling you in like 5 minutes in your office. And I hung up and I start walking and then I start going into a slight, it's very cinematic, but I start walking fast. Then I start running and I run to my office. And then he's saying, okay, here's the plan. You got it, kid. I think it's all crazy, but you got it. Now here's the idea. He said, you're going on the Tonight Show tonight. Because I'm sick of us getting scooped.
What?
They've scooped us the whole time. We're going to show that. We're going to flip the script on the media. He had this very like combative, sporty kind of.
Yeah.
So he said, Jay's going to just say, we got the new host for the late night show. Here he is. And you're going to walk out there. And he said, kick it in the balls, you know, and really show him who's who. And I'm just the kid that just came out of a record.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and he's like, shut up. Get in your car and get over to NBC right now before the press finds out. So the next thing I know, I'm driving over to, and I'm in a total panic. And then, sure enough, Jay calls me out. And I remembered Robert, and I think this is good. Robert was like, don't take any big swings.
Right.
You know, because the worst thing that
and
I could do.
Michelle in the background's going, I was kidding.
Yeah, yeah. She was like,
what did he do? You have a lot to lose.
Oh, no.
The Simpsons is a good gig.
Yeah. So what Robert said.
I just basically went out there and went. Yeah. You know, yeah, it's real, you know, and Jay was like, well, you know, good luck to you and whatever. And
you played
and
it straight.
I just played it straight. Like I remembered people were like, well, if that's the new host of Late Night. And I was like, you know, he didn't come out and kill. And I think Olmeyer really wanted me to go out there and say, like, all right, everybody, now listen to this, you know, and
that's do the crank thing again. Incredibly smart.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff,
I was not there. I was
in
New York.
Back in New York.
I was in New York.
And did you tune in?
You had to start producing.
I did.
Did you guys talk? Before he went on?
I don't think we probably
don't think so.
Okay. All
right. I'm not sure if we did it. I don't remember.
All right. So then what happened next with you two?
We had to figure out how to make a show.
Sona, what would you do with $100 billion? Seriously.
Oh, I would buy a country.
Okay. I would buy just a ton of yachts and private jets, and I would duct tape them all together and then just have it go in a circle in the Pacific Ocean.
What?
Yeah. I don't know, just to be a total jerk. Anyway, there is a correct answer.
Oh.
And it's build incredible cities in fantastical locations while competing with your friends to be the biggest tycoon in the world. What do you think of that answer?
That's better than mine.
Yep, and mine, which you can do with Monopoly Go, the hit mobile game that's so much fun, it's been downloaded over 150 million times. It's the fun of classic Monopoly on the go, anytime, anywhere, endless new surprises like tons of boards and crazy mini games. You can team up with your chums on community chess and tournaments to get big money, or you can go after their fortune changing rent on your properties or even pulling a bank heist on them. So much fun. It's incredible. So start building up your billions today. Go download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store and Google Play.
And Conan came back to New York, got a place.
I had to, the crazy thing is I had to go, they wanted to introduce me to the press in the Rainbow Room.
Yeah. Yep.
That was the first big hurdle was I had to immediately come east. It was not clear because then NBC started to get into it with Fox, and Fox was like, excuse me, he's under contract.
Oh. I can't believe
it. Yeah. Yeah.
And we were like, well, this one in a billion year right. accident yeah. just yes. happened Hello. Where one of your writers is going to get to. And it wasn't, again, I want to be clear, it was not The Simpsons. The Simpsons were right. really right. great about it, but there was an executive at Fox who was saying, no, I don't. So NBC and I think I had to
pay money.
I had to pay money, and NBC had to pay money to get me out of wow. my Simpsons contract.
Wow. That's crazy because yeah, at the time these shows were making so much money right. and they were nickel and diming every little thing you mm-hmm. could yeah. think of. It was
that's how they made it.
They weren't extra happy for you.
No, yeah. but
you had a line at the press conference.
Yes.
What was it?
The press conference had very much the feel of we all met. It was going to be in the Rainbow Room, which is the top of Rockefeller Center, and right. everyone from the press corps was going to be there, and I was going to go out and meet the press mm-hmm. and we all met at Lauren's apartment and the NBC people were there and then we walked through yep. the park. Yep. It is now early May. We're walking through the park and I'm seeing Rockefeller Center get closer and closer and oh, closer right. and I know that I have to go to the top of this tower and then meet the nastiest press yeah. In the history
also
of media.
This is cinematic as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we're walking there and then as we are getting to 30 Rock, trying to keep it light and trying to stay loose, a reporter comes up to me and says, I forget if he said he was from The Post or Newsweek, but he said, hey, Conan, my job is, I was at Letterman's. Letterman had had a press conference for his new CBS show okay. at Radio City like the week before. Okay. And of course, being, you know, he killed, destroyed.
Right.
He said, I was at Letterman's press conference last week and I know how many laughs he got and my job is to count how many laughs you get
no.
and see how you stack up.
And he
told me that oh. as we were going through on the north side.
That should be illegal.
Right in between Radio City and Rockefeller Center. We're going in right there, and he's like, my job's to count how many laughs. Oh, you know, so it was literally like, good luck, Spartacus, in the ring.
My God.
So wow. I go up there. Lauren talks briefly, and then they and there's a shot. I mean, Vanity Fair covered it at the time, and there's a great, the iconic photographer. Annie Lewis took a shot of me, a reverse shot. I'm in the front and it's the entire press corps and explosion of photographs.
Oh, wow.
And I'm a week and a half earlier, I was in the room at The Simpsons.
Right.
Yeah.
It's still not real.
No, but I remember that the thing that saved my ass was I get up to the microphone.
All right, now I remember.
And Stuttering John from the Howard Stern Show is there.
Yep.
And he's wearing he's wearing a fake mustache and fake glasses and like a wig. And so he goes like, Conan, he said, who did you have to sleep with to get this job? And I just said, no one I wasn't sleeping with before. Next question. And everybody laughed. And then I was like, hey, that's Stuttering John. John, take off the wig. Because his job was to fuck with me.
Yeah.
And I was loving it. And I was, anytime he'd say something, I'd be like, I would have fun with it. And then I was like, John, come on, take off the, and it ended up.
Wasn't there somebody said to you something about being a relative unknown?
No, you're a, yeah, he said, sir, aren't you a relative unknown? Aren't you a relative unknown? I said, sir, I am a complete unknown. And then people were
that's
like,
great.
Oh,
that's
he's,
great. That's
and
what
I remember,
I was thinking.
Yeah.
Foolishly, the press conference went really well. Yeah. And the take was, well, he's funny and it could work.
That's
and
all you wanted.
He got three laughs.
He got three
right,
laughs.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm dying to hear that the count. I want to dig up that article.
But
you did a thing that you've done every time since, I think, where you have an event is like
yeah.
if you can find one person
mm-hmm. yes.
to play
as a through line
of.
And to play off of. And you've always been great at.
I always try and find who's going to be my foil.
Out. Right.
Yeah.
And then use them as the through line. And Stuttering John was there and he was my foil. And to make things even crazier, that event's over. And the first thing I hear is Bob Wright of We Love the Crank.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Wright's
do the crank thing.
Bob Wright's having a 50th birthday party in Connecticut, and they want you to go up and be the one of the people
God.
Who
doesn't stop.
No, one of the people who speaks, and it's in 3 days. And I said, okay.
Oh,
so I come up with an idea for what I could do, and I worked on it with Robert. I get in a town car with Lorne because he's coming too. And we drive out to this nice part of Connecticut and we walk into this very fancy country club where there's a big party and I recognize all these famous people.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these people from the Today Show and right. all these mm-hmm. people from all the different NBC shows are there to salute Bob Wright on his 50th. And my job is to get up and speak. And I get there and who's standing ramrod straight in the corner but Johnny Carson.
Oh, my God.
And John, and I am the opener.
This guy can't catch a break.
I am the opener for Johnny Carson. And my previous experience is I did some pretty good improv at the Groundlings and thought of one good quip with Mimi Rogers. And so he's standing there and he's wearing sunglasses inside, remember? And he just looked, it's Johnny Carson. Right. It's the biggest thing. And suddenly I'm being introduced to him. And I said, well, I called him Mr. Carson. And he went, please call me Johnny. And I went, oh, Johnny. And he was very, he seemed kind of quiet and reserved. Mm-hmm. So I didn't say that much to him. And then I got up and I think the idea that I went with was giving a toast about someone I clearly don't know.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So it was like, what can I tell you about, you know, Bob Wright? And it was, all the jokes were things like, he's, I think, 5'9". he is the, and it's clear I've just looked stuff
just
up
looked
on
up.
Wikipedia, which actually didn't exist.
Didn't exist.
No.
Had that experience. And then he like applauded and gave like a little like, good for you kind of.
Yeah.
That was okay. It was fine. Right. And
It was no crank.
Yeah, it was no crank. Yeah.
And then you said, follow that, Carson.
Yeah, I should have totally been like, and now fucking Johnny Carson is going to try and
see it.
But then he got up and, of course, blew the lid off the place. But that was how rapidly insane things
that
were happening.
Non-stop.
You know, it was like Rainbow Room, meet the New York press and be confronted by Stuttering John. Off to open for Johnny Carson. And it was just this cavalcade of craziness, I remember. And then it was go meet all the affiliates. I had to go like around the United States and meet affiliates.
That seems at least like,
that's no
that
fun.
Seems like a cool down period compared to what you just described.
The one point I would make that I'm still blown away by is that this process of bullshittery that had to happen of press and affiliates and birthday parties and... By the time that's over, it's late May, early June, and our start date was September 13th.
Right. Yeah.
No band.
Uh-huh.
No writers. It's myself and Jeff.
Just
no
Jeff
bookers.
Ross.
Yeah.
No set. They've completely taken out the Letterman set, and so there's just a 6A is just an empty concrete rectangle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part that never makes sense to me is how quickly... You know, today, when I hear about someone doing a show, it's like, well, you'll see it in 6 months, you'll see it in a year, and I've got to figure. The idea that they found the person with the least experience in the history of the medium and said, you can really get started on June 1st.
Right.
I wasn't exactly experienced at doing a late night talk show.
Mm-mm.
I'd done a lot of different types of shows.
You did and Kids in the Hall, but that's a totally different pre-taped.
There is nothing. There were only two or three shows of that kind at the time. So, you know, I have no experience.
So you were both learning.
Yeah, it was crazy.
So
was
who
crazy.
Did you turn to for
I didn't
advice?
Really
Lauren? He's probably pretty busy.
A little bit of Lauren. You know, Lauren, there was we had a lot of Saturday Night Live people helping us and different variations of helping and not helping. I don't know if they were trying to kill us or what, but that's a whole nother episode.
You realize this is 9 podcasts.
We haven't even gotten to
1993.
I knew a lot of those people because I'd worked with them before and we sort of managed our way through that. And the process of getting a band was insane.
Right.
The process of getting a cell built was insane.
There is a story, a crazy story behind everything and moments of true despair to the point of there were, I think, maybe 7 different times just in that summer where I fantasized, no joke, about getting hurt. I didn't want to die. Like, but I remembered very clearly thinking if I was hit by a car, it was very clear to me that it can't be my fault. But if something were to happen to me and I'd been badly injured, I'd be off the hook.
That might be ideal.
Right. And that might be a good way. And so
I would also want an induced coma. I would.
Yes.
I just would want to check
out. It was generous. It was Robert Morton, who at the time was producing the Letterman show. He was generous.
Right. Yeah,
he was a friend of mine. He was,
you were already friends.
That's great.
But he was generous about it.
And was there an early moment you two remember being thrown into this where there was like a like things you bonded over in particular? Just.
We've never bonded.
No.
8 minutes
we
ago.
Want you to hug.
8 minutes ago, I really started to think, this Jeff Ross guy, there's something to him.
My whole thing was just try to make it as easy as possible for for Conan.
Right.
Just try to keep him away from all the bullshit. And uh-huh. At that time, it was kind of impossible because there were a lot of opposing forces.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and people who were less than helpful when they were made like they were being helpful. It was just a lot of craziness
going on.
And like
passive aggressive, I'm
sure.
Yeah,
a lot of craziness.
And I think the, and this is where I really have to, I think I've tried to say this a lot in my career and on my last TBS show, but it can't be said enough. The two big things that had to happen were initiated and made possible by Lorne. So first of all, there's this weird opening in the universe. I always make fun of Marvel movies because I hate a portal that opens in the sky. Right. I always think it's a portal opened and lazy writing came in another direction, another dimension. And so, but this weird portal opened in the sky where there was a second where this big TV job was kind of in play.
Mm-hmm.
And Lorne, for whatever reason, and I still maintain he may have fucked up, said, Conan O'Brien. Now, that's huge because Lorne was the only person in show business who had that power, one of the only people. And he's also clearly saw something and said, I think he could do it. Probably regretted it almost immediately. And I've actually told this to when I went back to SNL a couple of months ago. I said, I'm sure you regretted that immediately. And he was like, no, but I could tell like... in fairness to Lorne, he did that. And then the second thing he did was he said, Jeff Ross.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, over the years, who likes to ask a question more than once, the same question, would over the years go like, now, how did Jeff get into the equation? And I would always say, well, Lorne was the one who brought Jeff in. And he would go like, well, Jeff is very key. And I go, yes, Jeff's the key, you know. and then, you know, I'd count a year and a half. He'd be like, now tell me, how did Jeff? That's important because Jeff is very, he seems to complement your energy. Yes, that's right, Dad. We've talked about this several times. Yeah, shut up.
Is Lisa Kudrow still buying your clothes?
Yeah. Whatever happened to Lisa Kudrow? Well, a year later, she did it. I'm not done with my question. Anyway, Lorne, by just moving his pinky, he says, well, it's Conan O'Brien and it's Jeff Ross.
Right.
Yeah.
And I do think those are two massive key moves. And then the third move that needed to happen at the beginning was Robert Smigel.
Mm-hmm.
And I pushed for that. And of course, I only knew Robert because of SNL, where I'd worked with him for all these years. And I knew that he had the sensibility, like we used to talk about this. We used to talk about comedy. And I knew that Robert kind of had to be there. And Lorne, you know, I think was reluctant to lose Robert from SNL. Right. Yeah. And that was a whole story. But when you think about it, the three main players that needed to happen for everything else to happen really come through
right
Lorne
at the top.
And SNL. True. And they happen fairly quickly, and then the rest is, I always think it's one of those movies, like you start with Robin Hood and he's walking through the forest, and then, you know, he starts fighting with someone on a stream, and it's Friar Tuck, you're with me, and then you pick up people as you go. Right. I think of it as Jeff and I pretty much start the journey out together, and Robert's there almost immediately, then it's the three of us, and then it's this whole odyssey
of merry men.
You know, literally, Jeff Garland saying, hey, check out this guy, Andy Richter. Mm-hmm. And we do, and I have lunch with him and meet him at a deli, as I've said many times. Mm-hmm. And he came in, and I immediately, I mean, a lot of it's instinctual, but immediately I was like, this guy needs to be part of this adventure.
Yeah.
Because he's fantastic.
You were like Lorne all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You were just like, ah, this guy.
The stuff that's fascinating to me is how do you, those initial elements are the fascinating part. And then everything else is...
Right.
A good story, and you guys have done a great job of mining these incredible stories because we put together, because it happened so quickly and so strangely, we put together a group of people that didn't know anything about TV and really didn't have experience. And then we ended up, you know, we inherited our crew from Letterman's old show.
A lot of them, right?
And he did, Dave did a very different kind of show, and suddenly we're telling 62-year-old cameramen who've never had to move, we've got a funny idea where Conan races down 6th Avenue and you follow him. And they were like, how about you go fuck yourself?
I'll be on a break.
Yeah. And once you hit September 13th, when we premiere 93, the next 2 years, is us.
Year and a half.
Two and a half.
No, year and a half, too.
I think it was over solid two years of we're in terrible, terrible danger of being canceled in a second. We were just canceled at one point, but also justified fear because, there was. We were.
I mean, you've said it was week to week for a while. Was and then just, it was almost day to day.
All we did was, this is the way I felt, is I had like visors on. I was like one of those horses.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You still are very horse-like.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
We give Jeff a sugar cube after every anecdote. Like, he gets a sugar bag.
I could use one now if this goes much longer.
Oh, my God. Jeff, we haven't even gotten to your side about all this. We're going to go back and retell the whole story through her
voice.
But
you realize that this is...
You just have to put your head down and not pay attention to a lot of things. Just go forward.
I mean, I think it's just... I still, to this day, cannot believe that somehow we got away with it.
I don't. 100%.
And, you know, one thing I wanted to say, I had this, one of the surreal moments just pop into my head, and one of them was... We move in and we take over these offices. They were offices that had been like an insurance company or something. but that ended up being our late night offices for all those 16 years. And we move in and there's nobody yet. I mean, literally there's myself and Jeff.
We had offices on the opposite. Remember the opposite corners? Yeah.
Jeff.
And there was nobody else there.
Jeff
so
took
you were literally 100 feet apart.
We had two corners.
Wow. At least 100 feet apart. But Jeff had the offices that looked at the sign for Radio City on the north side. And I had the south side. I was down like where the writers are and Jeff was up where it's, you know, all the adults who make the show really work are up on that side. And I was with the idiots. But at the time, there's no one's there yet. People are in the process of hiring people. So you could look it up, but Dave winds up his last late night show, probably sometime in June, I'm guessing. And where am I? I'm on the ninth floor in my office and I'm watching the feed.
Yeah.
And I'm watching Dave record his last show.
Just three floors below you.
Three floors below me. And he's recording it in the studio that I'm going to take over. Mm-hmm. But we haven't even gotten started yet. And I'm sitting there watching it. And so Dave does this amazing show, last show. And then Bruce Springsteen comes out and does Glory Days.
Right.
And I'm in my office watching this. And then it ends. And Dave does his final words. And he says, I'm moving on. This has been really... And he says, the last thing he says... is Conan O'Brien, I don't know much about the man, but I believe he shot somebody once, you know, which would always get a...
Sure.
And then he said, I hope someday he has me on his show. That'd be nice. Anyway, good night. That ends. And I'm like, for the first time, as long as Dave was on the air, I felt this isn't real.
Yeah. It's down
the
road.
Once he left, suddenly it's like, you're up, kid.
Oh, wait.
Right.
Put on
DiMaggio just left the batter's box. He just hit a home run.
Yeah.
You're up.
Yeah, hope you're warm.
Oh, here I am.
Also,
this
went...
This bat feels heavy.
We went down there after the show.
I was going to get to that, yeah.
And what was surreal to me, first of all, they're all there.
Who's they? Joe just spelled the executives.
Down there. They were all... Everybody's down there.
No, but it's like... Letterman's Dave. Just done his last show, so there's a whole thing... Yeah. Bruce is in the hall wearing like a flannel shirt and having a bottle of literally like a, he had like a beer bottle because someone had put beer out.
It's a prop.
And it was just filled with La Croix. It had La Croix water
in
it.
Part of his look.
Give me my La Croix that looks like beer. So Dave was in this little tiny dressing room and someone said, you should go in there. Suddenly I'm in a tiny, tiny room with David Letterman, who's just done his last show. And he wishes me well. And I said, well, that was really amazing. And well, I should go and start making the show that will replace your iconic show, I suppose. And I walk outside and Tom Hanks was a guest on the last show. And Tom Hanks is there with his wife, Rita. And Tom looks at me and I knew him from being a writer on SNL. And he used to call Robert, Bob Odenkirk and I, and Greg Daniels, the Boiler Room Boys. He'd be like, hey, fellas, we're the Boiler Room fellas. Get over here, fellas. And so he was like, he looked at me and he stared right through me and like put his hands on my shoulders and he said, what's just happened to you doesn't happen.
Wow.
It never happens. And I don't know exactly how to take that. And I don't think he meant anything, but he was pretty much saying... This is kind of unprecedented in show business history. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to go now.
Don't fuck this up.
Yeah. I also remember being...
That I remember very clearly.
I also remember being in that hallway, and immediately they were ripping the set out.
Oh my God. Oh,
and I was just watching them rip the set out.
And shitting on the floor.
Pretty much. And just going, and our set experience had a little to be desired, you know, with that first set. And we're going through all that. And I'm watching the set being ripped out. And I'm just like, oh my God.
Wow.
Oh, that's real.
This is, we just got to figure it out.
So it was empty by probably the next 2 days later.
Yeah.
There's a thing.
I think that night.
There's a thing you hear about a lot back before people, there were rules and laws about childcare that if you wanted to teach a child to swim,
right,
you would just take the child and throw him into the deep end of the pool.
Yeah.
This was like, I'm taking the child into a C-47 plane and throwing them out into the Arctic waters. Right. Yes. And the worst thing about it all was like, I think if it had been done to me, my psychological response would have been, you know, if I was told by the government, your name's been selected randomly and you have to replace Letterman and this is your job to save America, I would have had a very different attitude about it. But in my own fucked up Catholic way, I think I was very much, you asked for this, asshole.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I
got what you wanted.
I had, you got what you wanted, fucker. Now let's see. You know, you put yourself in this position. You said yes because someone just had to host a talk show. And the voice in my head is far more punitive than anything anyone can ever say to me. And so I just beat the shit out of myself all the time. Yeah. And I now think that the crazy thing about when I look at the audition or the times I've seen it since, I was more relaxed in the audition than I was on television because
that makes sense.
Psychologically,
well,
I'm being asked to try out. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll do my part.
Nothing to lose.
And then the minute I took it very seriously.
Yes.
And it just took me a while for the volume. It was literally the volume and the amount of work we were doing and the volume of shows. And it's getting Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours.
Right.
Yeah.
The hard way in front of everybody.
In front of it.
In front of everybody.
And so part of it to
you could probably see, some program could probably take one image, three images a show from every show the first 2 years and speed them up. And you would literally see somebody, you know, my skeletal structure would change from the sheer, I wanted it to work. I was not going to not work.
Right.
I was remember thinking it was, this is going to work because it has to work because being a joke trivia question is not an option.
Right. Yeah. But to me, just learning to do that on the job, because you mentioned like Tina Fey and, you know, Seth, like, yes, they were writer background, but then they had all this performance experience kind of under the radar.
At Second City.
Almost everyone on television started, you know, Letterman was a weatherman and even that.
Yeah,
it's true. Just that little practice.
Just and you, me in front of a camera. Just,
right.
And to be fair, I used to go to department stores a lot that were selling televisions, and they used to have a video camera, and I would do the thing where I swear to God, I had spent a lot
not
of time.
That impressed.
Yeah, I had really
I take it back.
Really gotten my chops, but it was
Floor Five.
Yeah, it is a very improbable story. And what's crazy to me is that's the beginning.
Yeah.
And we've told you 1/20th of the good stuff because there's so much insanity that happened, and we're saving that for the book. but that's just the beginning.
Yeah.
And you could believe like, and then finally the ship righted itself and went off to have a pleasant career. We haven't gotten to the Tonight Show. Like, that is in every way as insane and unprecedented and crazy and counterintuitive as the beginning.
Yes.
And that happens 16 years later.
Yes. Yeah, what I was going to say was...
isn't that crazy?
What's fascinating is we tell this part of the story and then I was about to say, well, and then we went up those elevators in the coolest building that you could do television in the world for the next 16 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The volume of stuff and the variety of things that we tried, I can't even... I see it now and I have no connection to it. Yeah. So, I mean, we used to do a piece where we would do a whole like soap opera in front of the audience and with famous people.
John Lithgow did it once.
John Lithgow did it.
Martin Sheen
did it. And we would have people in the audience wear a green like sock.
A green screen.
Green screen over their head so that we could drop them in and put their heads on the bodies of actors who were there so that the audience would have a line, an audience member who just showed up.
Yeah.
And Paula's looking at me horrified. Yeah,
no recollection.
Yeah, Paula Davis is here.
It was one of the first hires.
Stay in your seat.
It was one of the early hires.
It was called Paula Davis, one of the first people we hired to be our booker. And she's sitting here. And Paula, you don't even remember this. Yeah. You booked it. You booked.
She didn't know you hosted.
Yeah. I'm Conan, by the way. She's like, where's Corden? I'm like, okay, we'll get to that. But
his American accent is impressive.
There are maybe 75 to 100 sketches or more that someone could tell me we did.
Right.
And I would say that don't do that. How would that even work? And Stay in Your Seat Theater, it was called. Yeah. So that
it was putting out a newspaper every day, and there was you could never not move the clock back.
And then, in the middle of that, somebody says, let's do the show on the Circle Line.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's get a Circle Line.
Right.
Well, a Circle Line boat. That. Yeah. For right. the boats that go around Manhattan.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's, I have to say, Robert gets a lot of credit for. Mm-hmm. Robert has large eyes. Like, there's that old saying my grandmother used to say, if you didn't finish your food, she'd say, well, your eyes were bigger than your stomach.
Right.
Yeah.
And Robert has creatively huge eyes.
Like, yes.
Let's rent a Zeppelin.
Yes.
Let's fill it with cheddar cheese. Let's get Paula to book.
And he makes it happen.
Yeah. And let's get Paula.
He
wills it through an insane, you know, and things get crazy and hairy, and there are fist fights, and there's shouting. And maybe people get killed during the sketch.
Sure.
Who knows? But the whole thing was, there was this, when we were really taking heat early on, through at 93, and people are, at the time, there were reviews that said things like, it would be really nice if, you know, Conan died, you know, and it'd be great if Andy died with him. Right. You know, it just people were just very upset by it. And that was actually in print, I think, once. But
your hometown paper.
Yeah.
Your father wrote
it. I was going to say, written by Dr. Thomas O'Brien.
if he died, it wouldn't be his fault. You see,
he never adequately explained Jeff Ross to me.
Yeah.
And now he must be punished.
There was a time when I think even Lauren was saying, couldn't you just interview people? And couldn't it be like, because our comedy was very aggressive and aggressively strange. And I think still looks that way. And they thought, well, this Conan guy, he cleans up nice and he's affable.
Right.
Why can't he just be affable and chat with people?
There's
less sticky edges. Instead, Conan's yodeling and he's wearing a bikini and Andy's dressed as a monkey.
Right.
And there's a punk rock element to it. Like it or go fuck yourself. Yeah. And,
But one of the great things about that, when you wound up your show on TBS last year, were all these successful, like Seth Rogen and all these other big names this wouldn't even occur to you at the time.
Formative.
You were just trying to do a show every night.
Yeah.
They all ate the feast of all this comedy you were making.
Yeah, we're like, and finally someone's making comedy for me, people felt.
That must have been very satisfying.
It was, but I have to say, I don't know how you felt, Jeff, but I mean, and so many people, I think the thing that gratifies me the most is that, you know, haters and Mulaney's and all these people who are so crazy talented and good at what they do and brilliant, and they say nice things about and what our show meant to them back in the day. And my immediate response is, couldn't you have said anything? Because nothing
you're
was
old enough to write.
Yeah, like
at
couldn't
the
you
time.
Have written
us?
Why weren't you in Nielsen House?
Mr. O'Brien.
Well, in fairness to that, there were a couple of situations where somebody's kids.
Yes.
They were hearing, like, executives. Yeah. Who was it?
There was a guy who, and again, this is probably for another installment, but there was a guy who was sort of hired to kick us in the ass.
No.
And, you know, let's get this thing moving again. I mean, we got to figure this out. And it was like an episode of a sitcom where character comes in, a drill sergeant moves in with the family.
Oh,
and boy, does he turn things upside down. But I remembered him telling us, you got to pull this together. You got to da da da. Then he went off to visit his son, who went to Boston College. So he went to visit his son, and he was hanging out in the dorm room. He's like, so guys, you know, tell me, what is everybody watching these days? What are the kids loving?
Yeah.
And he said the dorm room was like, Conan.
Wow.
And he was saying, No, seriously. You know, did you guys like Jag?
That show's on its way out. Yeah.
Do you guys like Caroline in the City, right? And they were like, no, it's we watch Conan. It's so great and weird. And to his credit, he did repeat that. He told me, he didn't have to tell me, but he told me.
Well, he's got to take credit for it.
I mean, in the end, that's probably the kind of thing that saved us.
Yes.
I mean, the first thing that saved us was nobody was paying attention. We could just do whatever we wanted.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it became...
After the initial rush.
I think what helped save us is that we were in New York.
Yeah.
And had we been in Los Angeles, where they could come in... You know, if we had been in Los Angeles, they could have been there every day and they would have seen me putting on an octopus costume.
Right.
Right.
And us putting a green felt sock over Martin Sheen's head.
Right.
And they would have said, stop. We just saw that on the feed.
Yeah.
Stop.
Yeah.
Have Dick Cavett on and interview him and be pleasant to you, motherfucker. And instead, and also I think there was we were a car accident. People stayed away from us for a while because no one wanted to own it. And we have to give a shout out to someone who was a real stalwart, Rick Ludwin, who is no longer with us. Rick Ludwin was the NBC executive in charge of Late Night. And he was horrified by a lot that we were doing early on.
Yeah.
But he was there and he was watching audiences laugh at us.
He was the first executive to get it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And had the only one with the balls to go into a room and go, it's good.
He said, he said something.
I don't get it.
He said, something's happening here. You know, there's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. You can edit that out or actually put music
we'll
to
loop it.
There's a
and
man
it as a
I don't think
gone
anyone's
going
to associate that with the actual song.
I've got to beware. It's time to stop. Don't make that show. Everybody says my favorite Stooge is Mo. Anyway.
this is why I really... topical.
You know what? If I had said...
Weird Al hadn't come along.
if I had sung that ditty at my rehearsal, you wouldn't know me now. I'd be at the guy at IKEA.
I know. There was a divine force helping you through it.
Helping me not make stupid songs up. But Rick Ludwin said there's something happening there. And he just doubled down and went to bat for us and remained a good friend of us all through, everything.
Yeah.
And even through the Tonight Show craziness was like, nope, disagreed with people audibly and got him fired.
What are
well,
the rich?
Well, yeah, we have to wrap this up.
We do have to wrap this up. So everyone can just look up the Tonight Show.
Can we go for another 2 hours?
And the Serious Deal. People can read about that online.
Well, this was
will be a new spin-off series.
This was
could
cathartic.
Run 20 seasons.
But this is amazing.
It's tough, and I know I run off at the mouth, but it's very. I don't talk about this stuff a lot, and so when it comes up, in this forum, you realize it's like PTSD.
Right.
You start talking and it's hard to stop.
No, it felt very visceral. Like you were there and you were remembering the Lucite table and it was nice seeing all
those
details.
It's also easier to talk to you guys about it because you know what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
But also the process of talking about it, it's almost like to reaffirm that it really happened.
Yeah.
Because it was so,
that's why I will say I'm grateful to you guys for doing this podcast because as much as I have trouble listening to
our podcast.
Well, it's just the lack of chemistry. Let's get a robot and a bar of soap. And
I'll have you know.
No.
I hope I'm the soap.
Oh, you are definitely the soap.
I love being a robot.
But bleep.
And where's my oil? You know the joint.
No, I have trouble. I have trouble going back there sometimes. You know what I mean? I have trouble going back but the fact that you guys are talking to Robert and Bill Tull and you are, when I heard that you guys had done a deep dive on the old-timey baseball remote and found Nell.
Yes.
Yeah, she hasn't forgotten you.
And found her and that is a magical moment in my life.
Yeah.
This is very name droppy, but Paul and I went and saw Jack White do his show recently. And he was telling me afterwards, we both realized we're going to be in the Seattle area around the same time. And he said, I'm playing a baseball game then with a bunch of friends and I'm going to be in there because he's on tour. And he said, you should stop by. You could play with us. And he said, and you could do it as an old timey guy. And then he's like quoting from it.
And
I'm realizing he probably saw that when he was like eight, you know?
Why didn't he write a letter?
Exactly.
That's what got him into comedy.
I'm really grateful that you guys are doing this because you know, you can love us, you can hate us, but whatever happened during this crazy 28, 29 year span was authentic, kooky, and involved a lot of brilliant, weird, difficult, lovable people, you know, in this movable feast that just seems to, I mean, now it's continuing in audio form and I think will morph into other things, but I just love that you guys are getting these stories down because none of us should have ever been allowed to be in Rockefeller Center or Warner Brothers or any of these places. It's insane. And I love that you're getting this sort of oral history of a terrible mistake.
Right, right, right.
Well, people love talking about it too. I mean, it's easy to get, and same, once the juices start flowing, it's fond memories and you've meant a lot to so many people.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories adjacent to your story.
Yeah.
You might not want to know about.
Yeah, I don't want to know.
Speaking of Bill Tullin,
I don't want to know what prison Bill was
that's
in.
That's who comes to mind.
Bill Tull was being led to the execution chamber when he heard on the radio.
They made me build the chamber.
Yeah. Final appeal.
He heard on the radio that Conan was the new host of Late Night, and he was like, that sounds good. And he wriggled free and got out a window.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you both.
Stop by anytime.
Anytime.
Yes. Thank you very much.
This is great, guys. Thank you.
That was mostly Conan and some Jeff Ross.
Yeah. And a little bit of us.
Oh, yeah. 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 We're sprinkled.
We were there.
It's such an amazing story.
It is. I know. I really don't get tired of it. I mean that.
No.
And there's new details always emerging as well.
You know, it's amazing to me hearing all of that. I think I've heard some of those stories separately, like little parts of it. And to hear it compressed like that, where he just went from one test to the next test to the next. It's.
Yeah. Oh, so stressful.
Oh, my. It's.
Just imagining.
It's just unbelievable.
It's like a nightmare.
There was no let up. It was just like. It was literally like going down a water slide that just never stopped. And it's just like.
With knives. Yeah.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And no water. Yeah. It is an amazing showbiz story. So
It is. I know. I can't wait for the made for TV movie about it. On Hallmark.
Sure.
You know what? This season has been so fun for me. I've loved hearing and talking to all the people that have been a part of the show.
It was great.
Touched so many people in so many different ways, and just everyone has such fond memories.
There's so many people. There just isn't enough time to. There's so many more people that I'd love to talk to and catch up with. But the people we had on were fantastic. The writers and then
so many writers. Oh my God, the Brian Rich story about when he applied for his own job and got it under an alias.
Right, because he was leaving the show. He reapplied to replace himself and got the job. Oh.
I know.
And then hired someone to play him as the quote new writer. It was just I'm so glad that story got to be told.
It's an epic story. Yeah.
And then all these other parts of it came out and then we dug up Nell, who is also famous in the Conan lore
from the old-timey baseball remote.
Right.
She's still doing her thing. She's still Nelling out.
Yeah. She really is an enigma. Like I don't.
Yeah.
She was seemed exactly the same. Yeah.
We talked to a former head of state, the former president of Finland.
Right. That's right.
Agreed to speak to us. We didn't trick her into it.
She was on our 100th episode along with Robert Smigel, who we discussed earlier.
That's right.
I think people really loved our, when we talked to Bill Tull and John Rau, the prop masters.
Yes. Oh, there's so many animal corpse stories.
I know. But they also just talked about straight up about the bedlam of getting the show together from their point of view every day back in 30 Rock. And I just love that, you know, you think of 30 Rock as a staid building and they were just
running just
some
mayhem.
Crazy schemes out of that prop room.
They were cutting wires and moving pipes around, dissolving animals in acid.
Right. All under extreme deadlines.
Yes. And for a good cause.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and you know what show I'm watching? And I think it's because of we got to interview her. I love that for you. And I think that show's really funny.
Oh, Vanessa Bayer's show?
Vanessa Bayer, who we interviewed.
Who was a former Conan intern.
Yeah, right. And she'd been a guest on the show, et cetera, et cetera. And And she, I remember the time she was talking about the show she was working on. And I was like, yeah, sure. Everyone's working on a show. And it's on Showtime. It's really, a really well done show.
Oh, that's great. I love her.
If you haven't watched it.
There's such a lot of talent that came through the Conan halls.
Yeah.
From intern to employee to guest.
Yeah.
It's been a really fun season.
Yeah, it's been fun. I've loved seeing you every week.
I know,
and
that's my favorite
chat.
Part. It's my has favorite been part. Talking to you.
Oh, it's been my favorite part too. I'm not even.
Sadly, the season is over.
Uh-huh.
It's been so much fun.
It's been a blast. And we'll keep in touch. We'll keep you acting.
Yeah. We'll keep you posted on anything that's coming up. And
see where Conan heads next, you know, in addition to the podcast, what else he's got up his sleeve.
Yeah, that's right. I'm ready to dig into his trash, maybe get some clues.
And if you like the show, you can support us by rating Inside Conan, an Important Hollywood Podcast on iTunes, and leave us a review.
Yeah, thanks for doing that.
Yes.
In advance.
Exactly.
Well, it's been a really fun season, and you know, we couldn't have done it without our listeners. Because why, Sweeney?
We love you.
It's true.
Thanks for letting me say it this time.
Inside Conan, an Important Hollywood Podcast, is hosted by Mike Sweeney and me, Jesse Gaskell.
Produced by Sean Doherty. Our production coordinator is Lisa Byrne.
Executive produced by Joanna Solotaroff, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross at Team Coco.
Engineered and mixed by Will Beckton.
Our talent bookers are Gina Batista and Paula Davis.
Thanks to Jimmy Vivino for our theme music and interstitials.
You can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts.
And of course, please subscribe and tell a friend to listen to Inside Conan on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or whatever platform you like best.
It's the Conan Show. Put on your hat. It's the Conan Show. Try on some spats. You're going to have a laugh. Give birth to a calf. It's Conan.
This has been a Team Coco production.
Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend is sponsored by ADT. Introducing ADT self-setup, featuring everything from motion sensors to Google Nest cams and the Nest doorbell with a battery or wired option. Easily install the ADT self-setup security system at your convenience. This is so good because I can't set up anything.
I know, me neither.
And they've made it simple. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm terrible. I can't get an electric toothbrush to function properly.
Yeah, so easy even Conan O'Brien can do it.
That's what they should say from now on. Yeah. No heavy-duty tools are needed. And if you need help, ADT can provide virtual assistance along the way. Also features Nest cams that can tell the difference between a person, an animal, a vehicle, or with the Nest doorbell, even a package.
That's cool.
That's cool. Plus, when every second counts, you can trust ADT's 24/7 professional monitoring. Go to ADT.com today or call 1-800-ADT-ASAP. Google, Nest Cam, Nest Doorbell, and Nest Aware are trademarks of Google LLC.